Florence Nightingale, the lady with the lamp. When we think of reformers, Florence Nightingale is one of the greatest of the modern reformers. Few people realize the enormous debt which the whole world owes to Florence Nightingale. This courageous reformer transformed hospitals and pioneered the modern nursing profession. No other person in history has done more to alleviate suffering and established a high standard of healthcare for the sick as Florence Nightingale. Before Florence Nightingale, the condition of hospitals and the nursing profession was in a degraded state, to put it nicely. Hospitals were dirty and overcrowded. Antiseptics were unknown. Doctors took it as a matter of honour to have as much blood and muck splattered all over their gowns, and they didn't bother to wash them for days and weeks because it was a sign of status to show how busy they were to have dirty surgeons' gowns. Scarcely any facilities for the training of nurses existed, and their pay was less than that for common labour in the field. Nurses were drawn from the undesirable sections of society, were commonly regarded as vulgar, uneducated, unclean, notorious for drunkenness and immorality, barely considered anything better than a prostitute. And so the whole nursing profession was so degraded, no decent gentlewoman would ever consider being a nurse. Now, Florence Nightingale was named after the town in Italy where she was born on 12th of May 1820. Her parents had this interesting habit of naming their children after the cities in which they were born. They travelled a lot. Until that time, Florence was always understood to be a man's name. But through her parents' tendency to name their children after the town of their birth, Florence has become an honoured woman's name ever since. Florence's parents were wealthy, well-connected. This is the home that she was brought up in. And Florence was highly educated. A governess taught her music and art, and her father, William, taught her Greek and Latin and German and French and Italian and grammar, history, mathematics, and philosophy. She was extremely well-read. She loved books. She immersed herself in her studies. She was one of the most educated girls of her time. She felt alienated from those around her and profoundly dissatisfied with what she called the emptiness of her existence. She was distressed at the pettiness of social life. She developed a passion for neatness and accuracy. In fact, she said her favorite subject was mathematics. Visitors described her as stubborn, strong-willed, very intelligent, and extraordinary. On the 7th of February, 1837, just before Florence turned 17 years old, Florence wrote, "God spoke to me and called me to his service." Florence traveled widely throughout Europe, even to Egypt. She was well aware of the misery of the poor. She became convinced that God had called her to reform the nursing profession and devote her life to alleviation of suffering for the sick. Her parents are horrified and expressly forbade her to pursue any such degrading profession. So Florence carried on her investigative studies and her correspondence concerning hygiene, sanitation, nursing in secret, as her parents would not approve. In her 20s, Florence was described as tall, slender, elegant, very straight, her hair of a rich brown, her complexion delicate, her grey eyes pensive, yet ready to light into mirth with a smile, the sweetest and most winning. This sketch was done by her sister, and you'll notice the owl. That owl she picked up in Athens. It was being abused by some Greek children. She rescued the owl, called it Athena, and it was her inseparable companion for many years. Her personal charm and intelligence, her wide reading and sincerity attracted many friendships and marriage proposals, three of which we know of that she spurned. Some to very rich, well-educated people, but she understood that would prevent her from carrying on her calling in nursing. At age of 30, Florence wrote, "I am 30, the age at which Christ began his mission. Now no more childish things, no more vain things, no more love, no more marriage. Now let, Lord, let me think only of thy will." And that's written in her diary, and you can see that in the Florence Nightingale Museum, which is attached to St. Thomas's Hospital in London, just on the other side of the bridge from Parliament. So walked across the bridge, past the Boadicea Monument, get to St. Thomas's, facing the House of Commons, Palace of Westminster, as the British call it, and there's St. Thomas Hospital and the Florence Nightingale Museum. She travelled to Germany to enroll at a college for deaconesses. She was a star student at the Lutheran Deaconess Training Institute at Kaiserswerth on the Rhine in Germany. And there she lived a Spartan existence in this school of deaconesses, rising at dawn, doing all the menial tasks, sharing the frugal meals of the sisterhood, and attending lectures and nursing. Just very much like a Protestant nunnery, convent, so to speak. On her return to England, she set up a sanatorium for sick governesses run by a committee of fine ladies. Not a snappy title, but that's the way they did things in Victorian England. This establishment for gentlewomen in Harley Street, London, was used to test the innovative ideas on healthcare. Now, at first, there was conflict with the committee. She is always arguing with men. And in time, all the members came to respect her innovations and skill because they thought she was off the wall on a whole lot of things, which she turned out in the end to be right on. In her treatment of the sick, her first principle was cleanliness and fresh air. Contrary to all the tenets that then held sway, if you've ever been to England, you'll notice the English people shut all the doors in the house. And if you walk into the living room and leave the door to the hallway open, they jump up and shut the door because, you know, a draft can kill you, apparently. And, I mean, even today, the average English person has this obsession with closing everything and living in these little rabbit warrens, whereas we'd have everything open. They have the other opposite idea. So she insisted on large open windows for hospital wards. Thoroughness, initiative and hygiene characterized the routines established by her, and she produced the most detailed study into the state of healthcare in Europe. She was just about to assume the superintendence of King's College Hospital when the Crimean War broke out, 1854. After the Battle of Elma, September 1854, the Times correspondent wrote on the shameful lack of proper provision for the care of the wounded after their heroic victory. I mean, you've got a war. You should expect that in a war there's going to be wounded. And they hadn't made provision. There were not sufficient surgeons, no dressers, no nurses, no linen for bandages, and yet no one was to blame. This was the first war in which the telegraph was used to wire dispatches back home, so for the first time, up-to-date reports kept the people in England informed on the course of the war and the horrors of having no proper medical care for the wounded. Now, you've all heard of the Chartered Light Brigade. That took place during the Crimean War. Alfred Lord Tennyson wrote the poem The Charge of the Light Brigade, published in 1854. Half a league, half a league, half a league onward, all in the valley of death rode the 600. Forward, the light brigade, charge for the guns, he said. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Forward, the light brigade, was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Cannon to the right of them, cannon to the left of them, cannon in front of them, volleyed and plundered. Stormed up with shot and shell, boldly they rode, and well, into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell, rode the 600. Flashed all their sabres bare, flashed as they turned in air, sabring the gunners there, charging an army, while all the world wondered. Plunged in the battle smoke, right through the line they broke. Cossack and Russian reeled from the sabre stroke. Shattered and sundered, then they rode back. But not the 600. Cannon to the right of them, cannon to the left of them, cannon behind them, volleyed and thundered. Stormed at with shot and shell. While horse and hero fell, they that had fought so well came through the jaws of death, back from the mouth of hell. All that was left of them, left of 600. When can their glory fade? Oh, the wild charge they made. All the world wondered. Honour the charger made. Honour the light brigade. Noble 600. Alfred Tennyson's poem was published 9th of December 1854 in the Examiner. Inspired by Psalm 23 of the Valley of the Shadow of Death, it highlights one of the most famous events of the long and costly, ultimately disastrous Crimean War. About 1 million people died in the Crimean War, by the way. The Light Brigade had been ordered into a nearly hopeless situation due to command, confusion, and incompetence, to put it nicely. Yet incredibly, the Light Brigade succeeded in reaching the Russian artillery at the end of that long valley, lined with artillery on both sides, and they actually succeeded in fighting their way out of a Russian trap, which they should never have been sent into in the first place. Most of the men actually made it back to their own lines, but they were all that survived badly injured. The Crimean War was called one of the first modern wars because it was the first to use modern technology like railways and telegraph. It was also one of the first wars to be documented extensively in photographs and written reports. And so the Crimean War exposed horrendous logistic failures in both the British and Russian armies and the French armies, which in a previous conflict might never have been reported, and the people wouldn't have known. So the reports of the war correspondence led to widespread demands for sweeping reforms in the military. This is outrageous. How can this be? How can there be no provision for our wounded? As an outcry of indignation rose through the country, the Secretary for War, Sir Sidney Herbert, who happened to be a personal friend of the Nightingale family and whom Florence had got to know on their tours of France and Italy, they moved in the same social circles, she is the only person he could think of who might be able to deal with this crisis. He asked, would she go and organize the care of the wounded in Crimea? Within 2 days of receiving this letter of appointment from the War Office, Florence Nightingale set out for Turkey. Within 2 days, can you imagine? 21st of October, 1854. All the way from Britain through the Mediterranean, through the Dardanelles, into the Black Sea. She was accompanied by 38 hand-picked volunteers whose ability she had proved. These were some pretty tough people to take on this kind of charge. Now, her sister wrote that Florence was as calm and composed in a furious haste as if she was going out for a walk or a stroll. Imagine, 2 days. With the announcement of her appointment by the government, Florence Nightingale came under national attention, became the target of a lot of controversy and prejudice. It was only after Queen Victoria gave Florence her personal public support that most of the accusations against Florence subsided, but not all. Many high officials objected to a woman being given charge of what's essentially a man's job. And indeed, war is a man's job, although these days you've got draft dodgers who send women into combat, but back then it would have been unthinkable. Others were astounded that a rich, popular, young, attractive gentlewoman was prepared to abandon her life of ease and luxury and safety in England to face dangers and horror and fearsome toil on the battlefield. But apparently Florence took absolutely no notice of her critics. She reached Scutari on the 4th of November, just in time to receive a flood of wounded from the Battle of Balaclava. This was the hospital, as she said, the worst designed hospital imaginable. While struggling to cope with the Herculean task of tending these casualties, a further 600 wounded arrived from the Battle of Inkerman. No provision made for the inevitable casualties of war, and here's somebody who had no real support, backup, no logistical support, meant to do the best she could under the circumstances. She endured the prejudice and opposition of military surgeons, endured unimaginable squalor, cholera epidemic, battled against bureaucratic bungling from the start. She reported that far more soldiers had died of disease than on the battlefield. Now, up till then, most people assumed you go to war, a person dies, they've died in battle. She exposed the fact that actually the vast amount of people die of disease and totally preventable infections, not of combat. And the situation was disastrous. What she encountered was something that was not set up for medical purposes at all. She described the hospitals as colossal calamities. There was no furniture, there were no cooking utensils, and Scutari was one big massive disease factory. The most practical thing is that the cemetery was close by. Toilets were blocked and overflowing. Rats were everywhere. The filth and stench of rotting wounds was overwhelming in the overcrowded rat and cockroach, lice-infested corridors and wards. When informed that essential items that she needed would take weeks of delay, authorization from England, and needed to wait official reaction of the Commission of Inquiry, Florence Nightingale used her own funds to set up a house in Scutari as a laundry, requisitioned a consignment of 27,000 shirts, which had not yet been released by the Board of Servant, the still on board ship, and like, nope. She just overruled everyone and said, this is coming to the hospital. And Florence ordered that the bales be opened at once, the material still at the hospital, red tape or no red tape, and she managed to get them to do it, despite the fact that she was just cutting across all the bureaucratic rank structure. Many officials were incensed and complained in newspapers of England, is this the way to manage the finances of a great nation? Miss Nightingale coolly draws a cheque. Well, in fact, Florence paid for many of the supplies out of her own funds, because she couldn't wait for the British government. Lives were at stake. This is one of the famous paintings done at the time of Florence Nightingale in the military hospital at Scutari. And the degradation that these poor soldiers had to endure after the horrors of the battlefield, that actually the hospitals were worse. They had more chance of surviving the battle than they had of surviving the hospital. Apparently unconcerned by the controversies and the furor surrounding her, Florence continued the work of cleaning up the shambles she found. And those of her workers who would not submit to the strict discipline or endure the necessary privations were promptly sent home. She did not hesitate to kick them out if they were not of the right attitude and disposition. Official obstructionism impeded her efforts at every step, but she overcame all opposition with her persistence and determination. As Florence wrote, I have no compassion for men who would rather see hundreds of lives lost than waive one scruple of the official rules. Red tape kills lives. Bureaucratic bungling. Florence organized staff, oversaw purchases, set up housekeeping, ordered furniture, supplied clothing, supervised daily routines, worked an average of 20 hours every day, performing the duties of cook, housekeeper, washerwoman, general dealer, and storekeeper, along with scavenger and nurse. Florence began and ended every hospital day routine with prayers. She also provided reading rooms and library books for the patients. Aside from her Bible at the Florence Nightingale Museum, you can also see her prayer book, which was constantly with her, praying with patients in particular. Taking them food, here in this case soup, ministering to people at night, caring for the patients, here obviously an officer, sword by the side of the bed with his hat. It was a custom before retiring to make a last tour of the wards. And her slender figure in nurse's uniform with rich brown hair covered by a white cap, passing lamp in hand down the long aisles between the rows of bed, bestowing comfort on the wounded, seemed like an angel to the hundreds of wounded and sick soldiers. And it was said in the reports that soldiers kissed her shadow, and she seemed to them like the angel of the Crimea. Florence visited the battlefront to set in place further reforms. Many lives are lost needlessly by lack of basic first aid at the first position, and so setting up also forward positions where they could do dressing stations before they get shipped to the hospital saved a lot more lives. Hospital mortality, the death rate of patients in hospital, before she took over the care of the war wounded in Crimea, was as high as 42%. That's 42 of every 100 patients would die in the hospital of mostly preventable diseases. Soon France brought hospital mortality down to only 2%. That's a massive change from 42% to 2%. As Dr. Benjamin Jarvid of Oxford declared, nobody knows how many lives are saved by your nurses in hospitals, how many thousands of soldiers who would have fallen victim to bad air, bad drainage, and bad ventilation are alive owing to your forethought and diligence. Forethought and diligence saves lives. And the stories that came from the people, do you know, at the end of the war, and they were looking, there was a military gathering, and it was challenged amongst officers to write which figure in the last war contributed the most and will be most remembered in history. And the different officers wrote in a piece of paper, came to the front, and every single name in there was Florence Nightingale. Every officer agreed. She's the one who did the most and is the one who's going to be remembered. And it's true. I mean, name a general from, or anybody from, the Crimean War. And most of us would be struggling, even historians amongst us, to think of someone else from the Crimean War that stands out. In fact, the only ones we can remember are the ones that actually caused the chaos. Florence Nightingale is the only one who did something good, from what we can tell, the whole lot from the British side at least. She's the father, or should we say the mother, of the pie diagram chart in order to convey to the British public the catastrophic situation. She invented, and it's even called to this day, the Nightingale Rose. So, this is from a book, and this is the Nightingale Rose. Now, to understand it, the red, or now it looks pink, the pink represents those who died of wounds, military deaths. Okay? You can see the little sliver of red. And then you see the grey is died of disease, like typhus and dysentery. And then other is the dark. And so it becomes instantly clear the vast majority of deaths in the Crimean War, as in most wars up to that stage, was due to easily preventable diseases that basic hygiene and dealing with infections, infection control would have prevented. And so to put it in by putting the original colour, which has been lost in old printing, the red represents those who died, and she's got this, of course, it's in months. Each one represents a month of that year. So the red represents those who died of wounds, in other words, from battle wounds, and the black is other causes, and the blue is preventable diseases, like infection and dysentery and cholera. And again, looking at it in terms of months, from 1854 to 1855, and you can see the way how the death tolls in battle, up and down depending on the battles. But from the time you have Florence Nightingale there, the preventable diseases starts to come down dramatically. And those are some great books. This is actually in the cabinet in the Florence Nightingale Museum that I visited. Florence Nightingale is well known for the attention. Yes?
Where is this museum?
It's in London. It's opposite. It's on the Thames, just opposite from the Palace of Westminster, and it's to the side of the St. Thomas's Hospital, which she founded. And so, basically, as you come over the bridge from Parliament and you turn right, the Florence Nightingale Museum is before St. Thomas's Hospital. So it's right there. The other side of the bridge from Boadicea's Monument. So we know of her for the care she gave to soldiers, but a recent lecture has highlighted how her statistical analysis, skilled administration, sharp tongue, really saved even more lives. I know of no class of murderers who have killed as many people as hospital architects. And this is one of the pictures that came out of the war, published in the Times of London, of some of her nurses caring for people in the field. Towards the end of the war, Florence succumbed to a severe fever, what they called trench fever, or Crimea fever, which could have easily taken her life. She recovered, but her health was so damaged she would never be as healthy again. In spite of her sickness and weakened condition, Florence refused to leave her post of duty until the British Army had evacuated Turkey at the end of the war in July 1856. So she stayed to the end and could truly say, "I've done my duty," which is the title of a book on Florence Nightingale in the Crimean War. Travelling under the false name of Miss Smith, she avoided the enthusiastic receptions that had been arranged for her, but she was received by Queen Victoria. When the Queen gives a summons, you know, she doesn't give you an invitation, the Queen summons you, so you don't have a choice. She persuaded Queen Victoria to support hospital reform by presenting her with these Nightingale roses, these pie diagrams, charts, and of course, the Queen instantly recognized what she was saying. You're losing most of your soldiers to completely preventable diseases that basic hygiene and sanitation would deal with. And Prince Albert described her as extremely modest. So work in Crimea was, for her, just the beginning. She founded the Nightingale Home for Training Nurses at St. Thomas's Hospital. This is St. Thomas's Hospital. And notice, it is designed with big windows. And it's designed in, you can see, a series of squares. The whole purpose is to provide every ward having big windows that open out so that they can, and during day those windows must be open. They want to be sure that all the patients have fresh air. Exactly the opposite mentality of this wear masks and keep people all cooped up business. This formed the base of the Royal Commission to reform medical care in the military. And the Army Medical Corps was transformed as a result of her efforts. So here you can see St. Thomas's is everything is designed so that there is no ward without big windows reaching into the opening. It's a very innovative design. Whereas you remember the picture of the Scutari Hospital, one big massive square. Most of the rooms had no outward ventilation, no windows, and just, you know, the worst. As she said, hospital architects are murderers. She took a deep interest in the sanitary and health measures adopted in India. Although she didn't go to India, she studied the statistics and gave constant communication to the Secretary of State for India to reform sanitation and health in that vast country, and doubtless contributed to saving the lives of hundreds of millions of people in India ultimately through the sanitation innovations brought in through her reforms. Florence launched the most significant campaigns to improve healthcare and prevent patients dying from causes that could have been prevented. She strove to learn from the past in order to save lives in the future. And you can see again, these massive windows is just part of her innovations. You must have lots of light. Light is excellent. In fact, if you can, you wheel the patients out into sunlight. Sunlight will improve and disinfect wounds better than anything. Sunlight and fresh air. Exact opposite of what had been done up till then. It was her goal to ensure that those who had suffered in Crimea had not suffered in vain. She changed forever the status of the nurse and the fate of the soldier. Through her efforts, soldiers came to be prized more and nurses came to be prized and respected more. And the lives of soldiers became more precious. Because she showed the people back home, your men do not need to die in such numbers. And they've been putting up with huge casualty rates, assuming this was all unavoidable war casualties, whereas in fact the vast majority were completely avoidable bungling by lack of hygiene and sanitation, lack of forethought, lack of planning. Her notes on hospitals and notes on nursing revealed that civilian hospitals were as bad, if not worse, than the military hospitals. Well, the military hospitals were bad enough, but the civilian hospitals turned out to be even worse. She worked late into night establishing effective training for nurses, setting new standards for sanitation and drainage. Her research reports dramatically improved working conditions for the poor and healthcare for the sick. Her requirements for nursing include that they must be sober, honest, truthful, trustworthy, punctual, quiet, orderly, cleanly, and neat. What's happened to our nurses lately? I mean, I remember when nurses were some of the most respected people in society, and my mother was a nurse. My mother-in-law was a nurse. In fact, we've got a cape there in the, and Nightingale lamp from graduation. And nurses were some of the most respected and trusted people in society. And yet what was one of the first things Nelson Mandela did, 94, closed down the nurses' training colleges, closed down the teachers' training colleges, and started to have people going straight in to nursing with no training. And it shows. And you can see the quality of healthcare is deteriorating. Having people who are just doing a job who don't have the Nightingale spirit, and it's just shocking how many patients have died as a result of the lowering of standards and having entitlement. And when I first ended up in hospital in Rhodesia, I remember being amazed at the nurses. Nurses in Bulawayo Hospital, they were strict, they were fun. It was interesting. The whole ward was brimming with such life and humor. You know, I was there with kidney stones, and they had me going around, doubled over, pushing the tea trolley in the morning. You know, you're the youngest. Yeah, kidney stone, doesn't matter. And at night, being woken up by the sister shining a torch, I was, are you asleep? Well, I was. Have you taken the sleeping tablets? Well, I was asleep. Well, I don't want you disturbing my readings. Now, I've got a good book tonight. Here, take your sleeping tablets. And when the matron came along, everyone was in fear, even in this. But everything ran well, and the hospitals were clean and neat, and there were such enjoyable environments. I mean, I must say, it was enjoyable being sick there because you had such good professional nurses and the whole attitude. And even I remember the nurse who were dealing with my father when he was dying. The high standards, it's just, they made all the difference. But lately, to find a Florence Nightingale type of nurse is rare indeed. Today, you've got some of the worst attitudes. And I remember when Christopher was getting his kidney transplant at Red Cross Hospital, I characterized what was going. I said, in South Africa, we have space age surgeons and stone age nurses. And it was staggering. The theft, the absolute outrageous nonsense going on in the hospital. Just going into Red Cross Hospital, for example, you'd see the fire doors propped open. I mean, the fire doors, which these doors must remain closed at all times, propped open with a brick and so on. And so I'd kick the bricks out every time I came to make the fire door shut to me. Fire doors are there for a reason. Next thing, there's a handwritten sign next to the formal printed sign saying, keep door open. And, well, after going into the ICU ward, there's all these, you know, no entry without gowns. So I wash and gloves and hats and mask and everything, and I walk in backwards into the ICU, and everyone's dressed normally. They looked at me like, oh, don't worry about that. I mean, here's someone who's just come out of ICU kidney transplant patient, and they're not bothering about me. And then I see my son's got no pillow. Where's the pillow? No, pillow's been stolen. Can you get another? No, they've all been stolen. Can I bring pillows home? Yes. How do I sterilize the pillows? Ah, don't worry, as long as they're washed. And that was the kind of mentality. My son couldn't have solid food, so he was wanting, you know, milkshakes, smoothies, put that in the fridge. When he wants them, stolen, empty. And nurses were the only ones there. They would be stealing from their own patients. Chris would complain he couldn't sleep at night because they're watching TV. Watching TV in ICU so loud that the patient can't sleep. Coming in, and I could hear my son's screams at the top floor before I'd even come up the last staircase, running in there, and he's in agony. He didn't complain much at all. It's got to be pretty bad if he's complaining. And I could hear the beeping of the machine and several machines all the way around the fifth floor, kidney patient ward. And absolute no nurse responding, nothing. Can't see a nurse anyway. Not the front desk. I go back. So I go into, we were up in E ward. I go into D ward and ask them for nurse to respond. And no, you've got to get a nurse from E ward. There's no nurse in E ward. That's not possible. She said, well, come and see. I said, oh, I know what. Went into the, I followed her. She opened the door into the tea room. And there all the nurses were with cake and so on. They're all having some, they all decide to stop and have cake at the same time. And the ward is just, you can hear the screams of patients in agony. There's all the alarms going off. Not a nurse cared. Not one. We get there, and I'm looking, and I mean, my mum brought me up with Florence Nightingale Fritz. You look at the patient's uncomfortable. Why? Well, as they know, but she's getting the morphine and so on and so forth. But then I saw, but his bandage is wet, and the mattress under his arm is wet. Start saying, no, no, you must take a bandage. As you took it, you could see the needle was on top of his skin. It had obviously come out. He wasn't getting any of the painkiller from a major operation. And they didn't notice something as basic as the patient's discomfort. You know, liquid, obviously the needle can't be in properly. They didn't know how to put it in properly. Oh my, I mean, the things that can go on and the shocking lack of proper nursing. I used to be a regular blood donor and white cell donor when I was, before I was getting malaria. After malaria they said, go away, go far away, don't come back, we don't want your blood. But before that I used to go regularly up to UCT and give white cells, and they'd take all your blood out one side, spin it around, and after 2 or 2.5 hours they'd have put all your blood back in, taken all the white cells off for a leukemia patient, and you'd be fine. Now, that was fine. I remember the one day after we'd had our dramatic changes in 94, and the nurse first of all decided to take the tube out of my right arm so I could watch my blood going in front of me, you know, not sort of tucked behind, so I'm watching my blood going up this way. And next thing is, I feel like heart attack type shock. The blood's coming back into my veins, ice cold. Ice cold. I mean, talk about your blood running cold. It literally was cold. And when I pointed out, oh, they forgot to switch on the heater. I mean, you know, after taking your blood through all the machines, taking the white cells off, they meant to reheat it so it comes in at normal temperature. And, you know, you can imagine that could have caused something serious because I was having trouble even talking. And another time came in there and they started trying to get the needles in my arms. And I've had nurses say, you know, oh, you've got nice veins, easy to find them. And kept getting wrong and sort of like going through the vein into felt it hitting bone, and had four nurses trying to stick the needle in me and make, you know, and my whole body's tensing up. There's no way you're getting anything through those muscles tensed like this. And after a while I said, whatever you're doing is not working. Please stop. And this nurse flings down the needle and storms out. I've got my blood sort of looking around for, not even given a cotton wool, and so on. And I'm sort of trying to find something in my pocket to stop the pumping blood there. And they all walked out. None of them, "I'm sorry, thanks for coming." Nothing like that. Not even a cup of tea. But anyway, they couldn't get the needle in. So all nurses are not equal. That's just basically what you're saying. But this is the standard. Struggling against ill health herself and surrounded by a colony of cats. All good people love cats. Florence Nightingale continued her crusade to save lives and provide efficient, effective health care for the infirmed. Here's some of the letters that, again, you see at the Nightingale Museum. Here's one of the last pictures of her with nursing graduates. Florence Nightingale told her nurses, "Christ is the author of our profession." Indeed, he is. "Preach the gospel, heal the sick, go and do likewise, love your neighbor, be like the Good Samaritan, go and do likewise." And all the teachings of Christ that inspired the medical profession, nursing profession, hospitals. That's why the symbol of a hospital is a red cross. Not a crescent moon, not a hammer and sickle, not a star. It's a red cross. The Florence Nightingale Museum reports that she wrote 200 publications and 13,000 letters, at least, that they've got. When it's doubtless more. Her most famous book, Notes on Nursing, has been translated in many languages, including German and Dutch and Danish and Swedish and Finnish. It remains a classic resource and textbook for nurses, managers and health planners to this day, even though it was written in the 1800s. It's so relevant to today. When I had to train military medics up in Sudan, and before I could get some real doctors and nurses up there, I mean, what do I know? Just that basic first aid that you get in the fire brigade in the army. But I did what I could. I took notes on nursing, and I'm traveling up to Sudan. I'm reading on the plane. And it's like, this is good stuff. This is very basic and relevant sanitation, things like this. So I had some, you know, the four B's, breathing, bleeding, breaks, and burns, things like this to teach. But Florence Nightingale has so much common sense. It's obviously missing from the average university today. My mother mentioned how many times, now she worked her way up from the bedpans all the way up to being a nurse, whereas she had some nursing sisters come straight from university with all the epaulets on their shoulders who fainted the first sight of blood. Well, fat lot of use that is as a nurse. They can't handle the sight of blood. And my mother would say, "My day is not complete if I haven't seen blood." She rose to the occasion of a medical emergency, which is why our son Christopher was a favorite grandson. She really loved medical emergencies. She would not let Christopher spend a night in the hospital alone. She had spent every night with him in the hospital. We could take the day shift, but night she was there by his bed because she didn't trust the nurses, not the ones we had around then, to care for her grandson. So, in Notes on Nursing, Florence dealt with all aspects of healthcare, including hygiene and bedding and diet, and emphasized the two most important principles of nursing. Observation, like the pulse and the appetite and the breathing of a patient, and things like if they're in pain and discomfort, and if their bandage that's meant to be covering where the drip is wet. Sensitivity to patients' needs and comforts. In fact, this is Florence Nightingale's traveling kit that, you know, I don't know what most people have in their handbags, but that was in hers. And she incorporated Bible studies and prayer meetings as part of her trainee nurses' routines, and she appointed chaplains for the hospitals. By the way, you can hear whole lectures on Florence Nightingale from the modern people without a single reference to her spiritual life, her call from God, her devotion, her Bible and New Testament. Just like you can go to the Red Cross and they have no idea that it was a Bible-believing evangelical Henry Dunant who founded the Red Cross. The amount of killing and cancelling culture of all of our Christian history that's been done today. So many people have no idea about the Christian heritage. When I went to Sweden and Denmark, I remember speaking about how the Vikings were converted. And, you know, "When were we converted?" they asked. And I said, "Look at your flags. You've got crosses." And they're, "No, but that's got nothing to do with Christ." And they didn't even know that that their ancestors had become Christian. They just assumed their country's always been secular. And "No, but I mean, our heritage was pagan." Well, that ended about 1,000 years ago, you know. And that's why you've got crosses and your flags. Here's the Florence Nightingale pledge. I solemnly pledge myself before God in the presence of this assembly to pass my life in purity and to practice my profession faithfully. I will abstain from whatever is deleterious and mischievous, and will not take or knowingly administer any harmful drug. Would that not be nice if we had a medical profession today who adhered to, I will not knowingly administer any harmful drug? Wow. That would sure make a difference, wouldn't it? I will do all in my power to maintain and elevate the standard of my profession, and will hold in confidence all personal matters committed to my keeping and all family affairs coming to my knowledge in the practice of my calling. By the way, Florence Nightingale makes clear in her Notes on Nursing that the primary duty of a nurse is to be the advocate for the patient and the patient's family. And this includes challenging the doctor, who may will through and dish out all-knowing directives, which the nurse may know is against the best interest of the patient. And I was not one of those brought up to believe that all doctors are just under God and that the doctor can't be wrong and you can never question the doctor. My mother gave us no end of stories of how the doctor prescribed something that would have killed the patient. The nurse had to intervene, and if it wasn't the nurse's intervention, the patient would have died and things like this. My mother told me when I was 6 years old, my finger got caught in a door and the whole door slammed on the door, on it. And my finger was just like paper thin. Went to the hospital and they wanted to amputate. My mother said no, she refused, made them just bandage up, and, you know, it looks a little different because the fingernails are a bit strange, but she said she's seen fingers and hands amputated that were less damaged than mine was. But the amount of dumb things done by many doctors. But nurses were trained to be an advocate for the patient, to sometimes be the protection between the patient and doctor, because the doctors don't always know. The doctor comes through and he spends a few minutes with the patient. The nurse might have spent hours with the patient, days, weeks in some cases. And so the nurse is meant to be the advocate for the patient's best interest and the wishes of the family, which these days, I think, is being lost. And I bet a lot of nurses in their training today don't even get taught that. But there was a time that nurses had to make this pledge. I don't know if they're still required to make this pledge, the Florence Nightingale pledge, but isn't this a lovely ceremony, all holding flowers and pledging? And it looks like it's a church venue where this is taking place. And so the Nightingale pledge, printed, distributed, many nurses would have it, it would be on the walls. It's been a long time since I've seen it in the hospital. Florence Nightingale said, I attribute my success to this. I never gave any excuse. I never accepted any excuse. Isn't that a good principle? You know, the way of failure is to give excuses. Failures make excuses. Winners make a plan. In border, muck and plum. We must make a plan. Nursing is an art, and if it is to be made an art, it requires an exclusive devotion, as hard a preparation as any painter's or sculptor's work. Because as hard as the preparation, any painter or sculptor's work, for what is the having to do with dead canvas or dead marble compared to having to do with a living body, the temple of God's Spirit? It is one of the fine arts. I had almost said it is the finest of fine arts. Now, if dealing with paint and canvas and marble is art, how about dealing with a human body, which is temple of the Holy Spirit? Is that not, as she said, the finest of arts? Well, it can be, if one does it as unto the Lord. A nurse is to maintain the air within the room as fresh as the air without, without lowering the temperature. If a patient is cold, if a patient is feverish, if a patient is faint, if he is sick after taking food, if he has a bed sore, it is generally the fault not of the disease, but of the nursing. That's quite a good standard. I don't know that they think like that in any government, anything. I mean, you can ask this anywhere in the world. If you're sick and money wasn't an option, which would you prefer? A private hospital or a government hospital? If you had to choose between a private hospital, which is secular, a private hospital, which is Christian, which would you choose? I mean, it's quite obvious. And plainly, one of the things is the difference between a mentality of entitlement and a mentality of stewardship and duty towards God and man. A person is committed to loving God with all their heart, soul, mind, strength, and loving their neighbour as herself, and doing everything as unto the Lord wholeheartedly, as one who's got to give an account to God. Doesn't that produce a higher standard? Here's some quotes of Florence Nightingale. To be a good nurse, one must be a good woman. One is truly nothing but a tinkling bell. She also said, till a married woman can be in possession of her own property, there can be no love or justice. Now, where's that coming from? Well, if you've seen, read any of the Jane Austen novels, you know that, unfortunately, in England at that time, property was owned by men. And a father couldn't even give his estate to his daughter. It had to go to some male cousin, you know, kind of attitude of this. And so, you know, these sort of things were obviously wrong, and Florence Nightingale campaigned for justice on that. You can arrest in some degree the course of a knave. That's a bad person. But with a fool, you don't know where you will find him next. In other words, a fool can be more damaging than even a knave. There is no part of my life upon which I can look back without pain. Now, Florence knew a lot of pain in her life. And amongst the different pain is she had many a time that she reflects in her diary, wondering with regret whether she did right in turning down different men who'd proposed to her. But she knew that she had a higher calling. But you can imagine there's still regrets and there's if onlys and whats. Moses was the greater man, for whereas Plato only formed a school which formed the world, Moses went straight to work on the world. So, yes, you can learn from Plato, but Moses has more to teach us. Give us back our suffering. We cry to heaven in our hearts. Suffering rather than indifferentism. For out of nothing comes nothing. But out of suffering may come the cure. Better have pain than paralysis. 100 struggle and drown in the breakers. One discovers the new world, but rather 10 times rather die in the surf, heralding the way to the new world, than stand idly on the shore. And there you can get a spirit. In other words, better to die trying than to not even try. Let us never consider ourselves finished nurses. We must be learning all of our lives. And that's from Proverbs. If we stop learning, we soon forget what we already know. You have to continually be learning. We must never reach a stage of, I've stopped learning. I've met people who say, I haven't read a book since I graduated from college or since I left school. And you just can only feel sorry for people like that. Their brain must be rotting away. Their intellect must be dying and decaying. A person who doesn't read, it's like a body that does no exercise. Reading is gym for the mind. If we don't read, then our mind's going to get flabby. Well, I'm sure there's other words than that. It basically dies. Florence Nightingale's writings on hospital planning and organization had a profound impact on healthcare worldwide. If a lot of things that we take for granted in hospitals, good hospitals, seems normal to us, we need to study what the world was like before Florence Nightingale and what the hospitals were like. Because she was so successful that a lot of what she achieved, we would not even think that remarkable today. Her far-sighted reform saved innumerable lives. Doubtless many of our ancestors, without which we wouldn't be alive today. She established nursing as a respectable profession. And very sad that people like Mandela have worked on bringing nursing back to the pre-Florence Nightingale stages of, I should say, the dark ages of nursing. We still have some good nurses out there, but shame, they are outnumbered. When, after most productive life, at age 90, Florence Nightingale died on the 13th of August, 1910. Over 1,000 nurses, many veterans of the Crimean War, attended a funeral service at St. Paul's in London. Now, the government wanted to give her a state funeral for her to be buried in Westminster Abbey. Her family, on her express wishes, insisted that she have a service in St. Paul's, which is the parish of London, instead of in Westminster Abbey, which is the royal, that's a state event. And for her to be buried in her family cemetery of their church back at home. And so these are veterans of the Crimean War. And this is the news report of the day. Notice they had these double-decker buses at that stage. And on her own request, a very simple tombstone with only her initials on it, F.N, with a cross, born 12th of May 1820, died 13th August 1910. That was her express wishes. Lord Stanley delivered this eulogy at St. Paul's: "I know of no person besides Mitch Nightingale who, within the past 100 years, has voluntarily encountered danger so imminent and undertaken offices so repulsive, working for a large and worthy object, in a pure spirit of duty towards God and compassion for man." Henry Dunant, the founder of the International Committee of the Red Cross, said that the inspiration for their movement came from Florence Nightingale. The Red Cross, the largest humanitarian organization on earth, has even recruited dogs. All over the world, some of the worst war-torn areas, the Red Cross is a powerful symbol. And Henry Dunant, the founder of the Red Cross, says Florence Nightingale was our inspiration. In Florence, where she was born, is this sign commemorating the birth in May of 1820 of Florence Nightingale. And in London, her house is a historic site as well. There's also the Nightingale Memorial, which has been set up in London, and lifting up the light, of course. Another Nightingale Memorial, this is in Parliament Street, in commemoration of her services. "Blessed are the merciful." That's a very appropriate verse for someone whose life was full of mercy. There are stained glass windows, remembering the lady with the lamp. And there's the Nightingale Home. This is a nursing home. And you'll see different memorials to Nightingale in all sorts of places, including just opposite from Big Ben and Palace Westminster is the Florence Nightingale Museum, which has exhibits including these. There was a time, I think from 1985 to 1995, that the £10 note had Florence Nightingale on it in Britain. But the biggest memorial in many ways is the memorial to the Crimean War veterans. And here in London, you can see the angel with the wreath, the crown of honour on the noble dead, with the soldiers' memorial. But to the side is, to the right, you can see Florence Nightingale's memorial. And quite appropriately to have the lady with the lamp commemorated, and Florence Nightingale with her lamp depicting her different work in negotiating for the good of the soldiers in Crimea, training the nurses. These are all part of this memorial in downtown London. Matthew 25, verse 34 to 40 says, "I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you? Or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." And so for good reason, Florence Nightingale is one of those victorious Christians who changed the world, one of the 32 chapters in the book Victorious Christians dedicated to Florence Nightingale. We will have the video and PowerPoint and audio of this on our Frontline Mission SA.org website by God's grace by the end of tomorrow. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Florence Nightingale. How many people here have been trained as nurses? You're trained as a nurse? No? Pauline, anyone else? Well, I think it's one of the regrets of my mother that none of her grandchildren or children followed her into nursing or medicine. She so often would tell me, oh, you've got lovely surgeon fingers. And then after a while, she was trying to get me into being a veterinary surgeon. And at one time, Andrea, my firstborn, was very interested in maybe following Florence Nightingale, but she soon became far more the academic. And my poor mother, she loved the medical profession. She really wants to see, maybe one of her great-grandchildren will end up in medical profession, because that to her was, that was life, just living on medical drama. So she came alive when there was a medical crisis. Any comments?
You, one of the quotes there was about sort of a feminist quote.
Yes.
About the, you know, owning property and so on. Did she know Emily Pankhurst?
No. There's no evidence that she ever knew her or met her, but we do know that she met with Charles Dickens. Charles Dickens was her contemporary. She met with David Livingstone. She heard Charles Spurgeon, went to his church and heard him preach, and met him socially as well. So she knew a lot of the people at that time, but there's no evidence that she is. I think she would have been too contemporary, too conservative for Emily Pankhurst. Emily Pankhurst was a radical. I mean, Emily Pankhurst was organizing bombings of, like, post boxes and smashing of windows.
What she did was lift up women
enormously. Just think, in the First World War, all the daughters of the Tsar and even the Tsarina herself were nurses in the First World War. And I think it became very respectable for princesses to enter into nursing after that. But, you know, before Florence Nightingale, unthinkable. But to think every female member of the Tsar's family became nurses for the soldiers, that's very impressive.
I want to comment on something that you said about the hospital care in our country and probably all over the world. What has happened is the unions has happened in the hospital. And it meant that the cleaners union had more, because they had more people, had more power in the hospital than the nurses and the doctors and so on. So the cleaners can decide, now we strike in the hospital, basically. Stand stop. And that's what happened. One of the things, and I think what happened is typically that the when I was training, I'm a physio, when I was training, there was a real hierarchical system in the hospital. The matron was in charge, the doctors bowed to her.
Yeah.
If you sat on that bed, you were really big to talk to. As a young physio, I remember being you can't sit on the bed, there's jobs, you know. And so on. So there was a real line, like in the army.
Mm.
And that changed big part, I think, since I don't think just in South Africa.
No, I'm sure this is it's part of the secularization of the world. As the world gets more secular, it gets more pagan. I mean, we've forgotten how much of a civilization is built on Christianity. If you take away the Christian foundations, it's like cutting a flower. It's cut off from the roots of its life. It might last for a while, but the beauty will fade. You're going to say it to me? Yes.
Was that a symbol that she came up with, or was that something that she was known for afterwards?
That's correct. She didn't come up with the lamp as a symbol. It was just a practical means of illumination.
Okay.
But people associate the lamp with her. And so at nurses' graduations, they'd often be given a ceremonial lamp like that.
Okay.
So Lenora kept her mother's nursing cape and that memorial. In fact, when Lenora went up to America to care for her mom in the last months, and she asked me to organize an order of service for her funeral, I made contact and checked and found, sure enough, in America, they have a nurse's team that will come to the burial service and take the service for the burial of a nurse. And so we were able to organize them. And she was actually buried in a military cemetery because her husband was entitled as a military veteran to buried in the cemetery. And so his wife was. And so in a military cemetery, they had a formal nurse's burial, which included the Florence Nightingale pledge and all. It was great. But yes, so that she didn't think of symbols. She wasn't. She was a statistician, mathematician, an organized person. But it's other people have now associated that with her.
I was just wondering if it had something to do with being salt and light or something like that. But I guess if it came after her.
Yeah, no, that's something people have attributed to.
Okay. I just remember being amazed at how quickly the lady could walk. Because they were trained to walk at high speed, but not to run, because running is a sign of panic, or can be interpreted.
Right, you walk swiftly,
so
but calm.
Yeah, calmly, but like at great speed.
Yeah.
No, they always seem to do that.
No, I mean, I remember no matter what was going on in in the hospitals when I've been there, nurses often responding with a smile, even when the situation was a crisis, because they're obviously very calming. You can't act panicked. If you act panicked, then everyone else is going to panic even more. So, my first mission was Hospital Christian Fellowship. Not that I was medical, but first missionary to come past Palms Baptist was Francis Grimm. So I joined HCF, and virtually his entire staff were nurses. And I must say, what a dedicated bunch. So dedicated, so incredibly committed. When I'd go back 5 years later, 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later, 40 years later, it's like the same people are still there. The continuity at Hospital Christian Fellowship is extraordinary. I mean, even now I'm in touch with people like Erica Frunewald and Betty Luke of Hospital Christian Fellowship. They're still there, still in HCF 40-something years later, 44 years later. And I joined HCF 44 years ago. And I must say, those kind of nurses, salt of the earth, I mean, such an example. You can only respect them. And they've made phenomenal missions. I mean, HCF's vision is more people pass to the hospitals of the world than to the churches. Communists might close churches, but they can't close hospitals. And if you evangelize and disciple the hospital staff, from doctors, nurses, through to pharmacists and orderlies, they will be able to be an ongoing witness and evangelistic and discipleship force for everyone coming in, both staff and patients, and family of patients. So to think of hospitals as becoming evangelistic and discipleship centers, I mean, that's such a great vision. And so Hospital Christian Fellowship, which is now known as Healthcare Christian Fellowship International, HCFI, still does phenomenal work around the world, well worth supporting. And I might say another group that's also very inspiring these days is Samaritan's Purse. For example, Samaritan's Purse is right there in Ukraine right now, doing a lot of key work, just as they were in Rwanda and Sudan. When I needed to recruit a medical mission for Sudan, I turned to Samaritan's Purse, and Franklin Graham sent his team up there, and they got the hospital up and running. So still today, when it comes to missions, remember the Great Commission originally was being given to the disciples, go out and heal the sick and preach the gospel. And so ministering to body, mind, and spirit has been very much a missionary emphasis. That's why David Livingstone came to Africa as a medical missionary and as a preacher of the gospel. Body, mind, and spirit. It's a good pattern. The first missionary to Equatoria, where our mission worked for so many years in Sudan, where our mission headquarters was established by Dr. Kenneth Fraser and his wife, Aline. Aline was a nurse in Flanders in the First World War, caring for the wounded in the First World War. Her husband was a general fighting the Ottoman Turks in the campaign in the Middle East. And afterwards, they came and established the first hospital, first school, first church in Equatoria. And again, the first minister body, then a minister mind. Finally, they had converts that could minister the spirit. Very balanced. Trained the first nurses, first teachers, and the first evangelists, pastors, and so on. That's the way missions always used to be, the three legs of the stool. Body, mind, spirit. Medical clinic, school, church. And the church was better when we were running the hospitals and the schools. But somewhere along the line, the church just either handed over or had it taken away from them, the schools and the hospitals. And the world is not better off for it. Imagine if the Christian church was still running the schools and the hospitals. It worked in Europe for over 1,000 years. And most of the hospitals and schools in Africa were established by missionaries and churches. And most of them right now are in the hands of governments. And I think we can all see the deterioration. You can't trust politicians to mould the minds of future voters, let alone to care for health. Next thing, they'll have you all wearing masks and having mandatory vaccinations. Conspiracy theory. Yes?
Yeah, hospitals are a great place for ministry, but unfortunately the last 2 years of this madness have stopped people going in. I mean, we had an open door in Somerset Hospital, and we haven't been there for 2 years.
That is such an outrage. And also bear in mind, prisoners have been denied visitors for the last 2 years. It's wicked. It's rough to being a prisoner.
We have a friend who goes into prison still.
Is he
in Joburg?
Are they letting him in? Because I heard they were blocking him.
They are doing some.
How does he get in?
I haven't talked to him about the detail of it, but I know they're going in.
Because I know people who had prison ministries who were blocked because of all the COVID cult. So,
Now I gather you started up again.
Well, that's good. I can only hope that but we should insist on these things. I mean, this is a reason why my wife chose to die at home. She did not want to be in a hospital where her family couldn't even visit her. And didn't want to die among strangers, most of whom probably don't care about it anyway. You know, it's not like the old nurses, but where the family could at least visit is one thing, but that's why we became the primary caregivers, because the amount of people, we know people who were not able to see their parents for the last months of their lives as they died in hospital, not allowed to visit them. I mean, that's just wickedness. Yeah, so prison ministry and hospital ministry is absolutely essential part of Christianity. It's written into Matthew 25. This is one of the key things God is going to be challenging and evaluating everyone by on the day of judgment, is how we've responded to the sick and the prisoners and the people in greatest need. So, any other comments, questions? Yes.
I just thought it was very interesting that Florence Nightingale compared the medical standard with the standard of art back then, because I can see it's kind of like parallel where the art and architecture is also literally garbage now, like modern art, and it's kind of matching.
Art reflects the culture.
And music.
So when you had beautiful art, it reflected a beautiful culture. When you've got ugly art, it's reflecting an ugly culture. When you've got meaningless art, it reflects a meaningless, and so on.
Sorry, I just want to say, you know, we're now nursing the World Health Organization, a very prestigious organization, and what the World Health Organization said, us nurses would take the protocol and go with it. But I mean, since all this has been happening and finding out who's running the World Health Organization, and it was evidence-based medicine, so now a lot of what's going on now isn't evidence-based. So the whole medical profession now, there's been a schism of, there's alternative views, and doctors being censored for going the alternative path. Doctors who've got a protocol, who've got to use things like remdesivir, where they've shown that it actually can cause death, things like that. So, I mean, for us, you know, trusting the doctors, trusting the nurses, trusting the World Health Organization, it's becoming quite difficult to go into a hospital now and say, have they got my best interest at heart? Are they there to heal me? Are they there to get to the bottom of it? Or, you know, the whole, all the drugs, you know, they're the pharma, you know, they're running the show now. Instead of doctors are being bought by the pharmaceutical industry, you know. So there's a lot of things that are threatening our health now in not trusting doctors and nurses and hospitals.
Right. So here's a horror statistic. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have poured over $11 billion, not Zimbabwe dollars, American dollars, $11 billion into universities, 460-odd universities worldwide, including WITS, UCT, Stellenbosch, University of the Free State, for goodness sakes. 460 odd universities around the world, $11 billion over the last 10 years, all into vaccine training for the medical faculties of these universities. Now, conflicts of interest. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation make billions from selling vaccines. And they have now gone, and what university is going to say no to donations of hundreds of millions for the, but it's designated for the medical faculties on train them on vaccines. Do they train them on the dangers of vaccines? Not on your life. Do they teach you on what's in the vaccines? No. The training is all in terms of brainwashing the next generation of medical professionals. These are the vaccines you must give at this age and at this situation, that and so on. It's basically brainwashing them. They've prostituted medical faculties in hundreds of universities around the world to being, in order to get this money from the vaccine producers, who are indemnified against liability for all the ill effects. And they're the ones training the medical professionals. This is serious conflict of interest. The integrity of the whole medical profession has been eroded from the university level. And that's not even counting how medical doctors can get financial remuneration for the amount of patients they prescribe for chemotherapy, for example, and so on. They literally get a financial kickback in terms of, this is just not ethical. There's conflict of interest in every level. So when you think that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation can literally buy up the medical profession by buying up their education training. Now imagine if your theological seminaries were all funded by the Mormons and Salt Lake City or the Jehovah's Witnesses. You know, nobody would tolerate that. Would you be happy if the communists were buying it up? But big pharma and big tech and big government and big business are in bed with one another, and they do not have our best interests at heart. So we should be seriously concerned. Yeah, I must say, my trust in the medical profession was never absolute, because my mother gave me a healthy sense of caution, skepticism, but I still basically thought that our best interests are not, but they make mistakes. Now, after what my wife's gone through, my trust in the medical profession is shattered. And after 2 years of the COVID cult, lockdown lunacy, masquerade madness, now the salvation by vaccination scam, my trust in any medical person who recommends and goes along with all this is gone. I have no trust in any medical professional who does not make a stand against these things and oppose them. And there are thousands of good, dedicated doctors who all make a stand, but like Dr. Susan Fosley. But Brian, you're going to add?
There's a program that I like watching, it's called War Room, and on there was a doctor, Naomi Wolf. And what has happened recently is that they've managed to get out of Pfizer all their research documents and, you know, trial data and what's been happening and adverse events, etc. Now, originally, Pfizer wouldn't hand the stuff over. So what happened was they went to court and Pfizer that was arranged that they give 300 pages a month. And apparently that would take 75 years for the whole lot to come out. So they went back to court and they got 55,000 pages a month. So what they did is they set up they asked for assistance to evaluate these pages, and they got something like 1,500 people and about 250 lawyers. So each person gets a number of pages, and they look through it, and they send it to him. And then stuff with legal implications goes into a separate chat room where these lawyers are looking at it. And the things that have come out there, I mean, Pfizer, for example, listed 9 pages of adverse events. And the people who died through the trials, I think there's 1,220, 3,000 or 4,000 people who were severely affected. And so all the strata has been collected with the idea of bringing these people to court. So it seems that now there are legal steps being taken by a number of organizations, doctors, and doctors frontline.
America's Frontline Doctors, very good bunch.
Yeah, very good.
And Doctors for Truth is another group. Elke de Klerk from Netherlands. They've got thousands of medical professionals, tens of thousands actually, supporting these. So it's not that the entire medical profession has been frosted and sold out.
Barrington Accord?
The Barrington Declaration, yeah. You know about that. Thousands of medical people signed that great Barrington Declaration.
Yes.
It was just basically censored.
There are 60,000 doctors and medical scientists, etc., who signed that.
Yeah. Mm.
So people who think that you know, there's uniform approach in medical, it's not that at all.
No, there's a lot of brainwashing. It's like all journalists agree, well, it's because we censored and deplatformed all the others, and all medical people agree, well, there's a few tens of thousands of you. No, well, we've deplatformed them. And censorship is the tool of people who are against the truth. So you can tell that you've been lied to when they censor the alternative opinion. Truth does not fear investigation. And in our country, we've got Dr. Susan Fosley, heart transplant surgeon since 1988, totally attacked for having made the comment that you're more danger from the vaccine than you are from the virus, which should be axiomatic. You know, 99.9% chance of surviving the virus, but there's more danger in the vaccine. Of course there is. Why would you want to take a vaccine for something that you can still get it afterwards, and you can still spread it, and you still got to wear the masks and do the test? Did anyone notice Cyril Ramaphosa Sono talking about, I mean, he's been vaccinated, and talking about how he had COVID after being vaccinated? But think how much worse it would have been if I hadn't had got vaccinated. And there is triple vaxxed Justin Trudeau in Canada, needed to go into quarantine because he had COVID. What was he triple vaxxed for? And now he's trying to force mandatory vaccination on others. Well, if you can still get it afterwards. You know, when I went to the Congo and I had to get yellow fever, I assumed that that protected me from yellow fever. I wouldn't have, if I got yellow fever, saying, oh, how wonderful, I've got the yellow fever inoculation. Imagine how much worse it would. No, you think it's failed. Obviously, if you get the disease, the vaccination's a failure. And this mentality that you can have these vaccination lunatics like Cyril Ramaphosa and Justin Trudeau getting COVID and then bragging that they were triple vaxxed, it just proves the whole thing is one big sham, and it's all about control. It's not about health. They don't care about your health, obviously, we know that. So these are just some examples of people who've, in the medical profession, who are making a stand, and there's groups all over. And in America, it's America's frontline doctors. In Europe, it is Doctors for Truth. Good people, get their videos, and you can get good alternatives. There's also Children's Health Defense, outstanding. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., outstanding group.